Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with Robert Yeager, Executive Director of Partners for Sacred Places, a Philadelphia-based nonprofit working nationally to conserve historic places of worship. Susan Lewis visits Chester County's Yellow Springs, a historic village where the waters and natural beauty of the countryside have been attracting visitors for centuries. We speak with architect Bernard Sawinski, the creator of the Liberty Bell Center in Philadelphia, and Jason Pfeiffer examines the role of the sound designer in theater. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Once upon a time, churches and other houses of worship were both thriving spiritual centers and community anchors across America. In the later part of the 20th century, demographics shifted and urban neighborhoods changed, and some once grandiose structures struggled to stay alive. Prompted by the belief that these religious centers were central to sustaining healthy communities, Partners for Sacred Places was founded in 1989. Its mission, to help preserve, protect, and empower these older places of worship to continue to serve their communities. It has since grown to represent over 100,000 organizations across America. I recently spoke with co-founder and executive director Robert Yeager and first asked him what Philadelphia's role is in this national organization.
Well, Partners for Sacred Places sees Philadelphia as our laboratory, and we develop a lot of services and programs here first. And two key things we're doing now. One is to train congregations on how they can tell the story of the community value of their buildings and convince others beyond their own memberships to care about their buildings and help preserve them, provide money and volunteer help. And that's an important development because many congregations are smaller than they once were. Another important thing we're doing is we've developed a $2 million capital fund, and we're providing major grants to help make repairs and renovations to religious properties. It's a model program that is really on the leading edge in America. We wanted it to be a model, and to our amazement and delight, within a few months after establishing it, and a funder in Texas got wind and gave us $1 million to start a program in Fort Worth, Texas.
What's inspiring this? Is it religious? Is it spirituality? Or is it architecture?
I think it's all the above. I think it's partly because people do recognize that these are often our finest buildings. There are often our grandest buildings, and they're full of artisanry and artwork, and they have a commanding presence in our neighborhoods. But I think equally important, people are recognizing that these are the places where kids are served, where the homeless are served, where the hungry are served. They are de facto community centers, especially in neighborhoods where there's a lot of difficulty and disadvantage and poverty. These are the last places that are active and viable and welcoming and safe for kids and others who really need help. And so I think our civic leaders are beginning to see that we need to sustain these places, both as cultural assets as well as places where people are served.
And what about the idea, there's been much criticism on the national level of the non-separation of church and state. Surely local government shouldn't be relying on religious groups to provide the kind of community service you describe.
Yeah, that is controversial. And I think a lot of people would say that there needs to be a balance. Government does have an important role, and we'd want to encourage that. But also congregations have played an important role and will always play an important role. These are places where people feel safe. And these are places that know the local needs and can adapt their programs and services to really meet those needs. And quite frankly, most of what congregations do happen in their own buildings. But these buildings are often really in very serious disrepair. So if we all acknowledge that they do play a role in providing a social safety net, that everybody needs to help them preserve these places.
How are you going to spend this $2 million?
Well, we've already spent much of it, actually, in major grants. We can provide as much as $100,000 to any given congregation. But first, they have to go through our training. First, we have to know that they know how to communicate their community value, find funders way beyond what we can give. Typically, they'll need to raise $1 million or more. So what we can give them will be a small fraction of what they need. So we need to be convinced that they know their story, they can tell that story to the right folks, they can build a broad constituency, and then they can qualify to come to us for a grant.
Tell us some of your success stories.
Well, there are several really great examples in Philadelphia alone. One is Calvary Methodist Church at 48th and Baltimore in West Philadelphia, a small congregation, But by participating in our programs and following some of these approaches that we encourage, they have raised well over $500,000 to stabilize their walls, to make a number of repairs, and they have filled their building with many, many activities that support the neighborhood, including several other congregations, a theater group, and a number of other social service programs. So they're viable, and they can last, they can be active indefinitely, even though they only have 40 or 50 members.
What projects are you waiting to come to fruition at the moment, then? Are there redevelopments or are there refurbishments that are coming to an end?
Well, one of the big ones that's in progress now and will probably take years to complete is St. Francis de Sales Church at 47th and Springfield. Their domes have been leaking and have been problematic for many, many years, but it's been very hard to figure out what the root problem was, and they now have done that. And so they have also received a grant of $100,000. But it's also a place that has an amazing school and amazing ministries. So it's a great example of fantastic Byzantine Revival church building, but also a place where the neighborhood is really well served with innovative programs.
Just one final question. Is there a caveat that you apply when awarding these grants that there must still be religious practice taking place in these sacred buildings? Because we've almost got to the point with many religious buildings and religious organizations where they have become almost entirely community assistance programs.
Well, to qualify for a grant, we have to be assured that there is good leadership, there's good energy, that it's not a dying congregation. Even though it could be small, we want to know that they're vigorous, that they continue their faith life and their congregational life, and they share their building, because that's a part of their ministry. Their view is, one way we serve and we live out our faith is by serving people in need. But yet there's still worship. There may be worship on Sunday morning or on Friday night or on Saturday, depending on the tradition. But yet for most of the week, they're living out their faith by opening their building up to house programs that serve the neighborhood. And it's that balance that we're really looking for.
Partners for Sacred Places, co-founder and executive director, Robert Yeager.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
A spot in rural Chester County has attracted visitors for centuries, for some because of its natural beauty, for others because of its alleged healing waters. Alternately home to Native Americans, 18th century vacationers, wounded soldiers, war orphans, fine arts students and filmmakers, this one-road village continues to attract people today. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis visits historic Yellow Springs.
What do the Lenape Native Americans, George Washington, Swedish Nightingale singer Jenny Lind, Pennsylvania Impressionist painter Daniel Garber, and actor Steve McQueen have in common? They lived very different lives at very different times, but all were drawn at one time or another to a meadow of wetlands in the Pennsylvania countryside. So today, when you pull up to the intersection of Yellow Springs and Art School Roads, you can conjure the ghosts of communities of people that have called this place home, or a home away from home. This is historic Yellow Springs. Yellow Springs was put on the map as early as 1722. The idea that water could cure was part of both Native American and European traditions. As English, Welsh, Irish, and Germans settled the land in Chester County, word spread about waters that were magical, healing, and very yellow.
My daughter, who's about 2 years old, calls it the icky water, which it does look pretty icky, but this is where the name Yellow Springs came from.
Rob Lukens is the executive director of Historic Yellow Springs, a nonprofit group dedicated to preserving and restoring the land and buildings that grew up around the springs here in the Pickering Creek watershed. We walk around the grounds, where there are actually three separate springs, each with different mineral content. The iron-colored yellow spring gurgles in a gazebo. The sulfur spring, once used for bathing, is sheltered by what's now called the Jenny Lind Springhouse. The last discovered, in the mid-1800s, is the magnesium spring, now protected in the Crystal Diamond Springhouse, where Rob Lukens unlocks the door.
This is the one spring that is nice and clear and looks like you'd actually want to get into it. And this is the one that it's called the Crystal Diamond Spring because of the, you see little bubbles that are coming up from the bottom of the spring. And so they look like little diamonds that are sparkling in the water. This spring actually, for many, many years, supplied all the water for the entire village up until, I believe it was about the 1970s. And I just had a little taste the other day, not in here, but outside, and it still does taste really good, actually.
Back in the mid-1700s, entrepreneurs built a tavern and operated bathhouses, which drew visitors from as far as the West Indies. Archivist and former executive director Sandy Momeyer says that even a trip from Philadelphia could take a while, depending on the stops.
There were packet boats that came up the Schuylkill River, and at Norristown they could take a stagecoach, and they would come out through Norristown, Phoenixville, Kimberton, to the Yellow Springs here.
During the Revolutionary War, Yellow Springs became temporary headquarters for General Washington, and in 1778, the site of the nation's first military hospital, a large three-story structure with wraparound porches on the hillside above the wetlands. Although the building was destroyed by fire in 1962, we can visit the ruins and an herb garden growing herbs like those used in soldier care. This hospital, says Director Rob Lukens, was a critical factor in the war effort.
You really can't tell the story about the Revolutionary War in Chester County, the Revolutionary War in general, Valley Forge, without talking about this hospital, because this was the best medical facility, the first medical facility that served soldiers during the American Revolution.
After the war, the spa reopened, turned the hospital into additional lodging, and built shelters for the springs. The fashionable resort attracted prominent statesmen like James Madison and Daniel Webster. With both health and recreational facilities, it had, says archivist Sandy Momeyer, something for everyone.
At one point, there were actually two separate hotels. One was supposed to be for those who were conscious of their health and wanted a quiet environment to heal. And the other place was promoted as a place where there was fine dining, wonderful spirits, fine dancing and music. So it was very, very social. So social to the fact that the local meeting house of Quakers in Euclid sent out a directive to all of their members and said that they were to keep their children away from the Yellow Springs Spa because promiscuous activity took place there. Then it meant card playing and dancing. And of course, I think we all have a different definition now.
Yellow Springs closed during the Civil War and afterwards was converted to one of eight boarding schools established by the Commonwealth to educate children left fatherless or orphaned. After the orphan school closed in 1912, education at Yellow Springs continued, but in a different form. Keeping pace with the Impressionist movement, Philadelphia's Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts purchased the property in 1916. Put in a bog garden, and converted the large 18th-century barn to a studio. Sally Ritter is the program director of the Chester Springs Studio, which continues the tradition of art education on the same site today.
The barn was used by the Academy for painting and drawing horses and sheep and goats. Now the upstairs section of the barn, where the horses were brought in for the Academy, is now our main painting studio. The downstairs part of the barn is our ceramic studio.
The Academy closed the school in the 1950s when the art world turned to abstract and non-representational art. But a new form of art took over at Yellow Springs. The filmmaker Shorty Yeaworth moved in, made the old hospital a studio, and turned the barn into a soundstage. His company produced Christian television and short films, as well as some full-length feature films, including one which would become a cult classic called The Blob, starring Steve McQueen. When the movie makers moved on in 1973, the 8-year-old Yellow Springs Association purchased the village, which was by then listed on the National Register of Historic Places. In 1976, historic Yellow Springs was born, or reborn, its mission to bring to life the richness of its past. After so many incarnations and reincarnations, what is the role of historic Yellow Springs today? Rob Lukens says that it is to protect, preserve, and somehow tell it all.
The amazing thing for me at Yellow Springs is that the history and the science, meaning the springs themselves and the environment, and the artistic heritage are all totally intertwined.
Historic Yellow Springs also hosts community events throughout the year, including an annual art show in the spring and an antique show in the fall.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The most visited tourist attraction in Philadelphia is, not surprisingly, the Liberty Bell Center. The bell was moved from a pavilion on Market Street, where it had resided since the bicentennial, to its new home on 6th Street between Market and Chestnut Streets in October 2003. The Liberty Bell Center incorporates three discrete but physically and thematically connected elements: a shaded outdoor arcade containing educational materials, an inside interpretive exhibit hall, and a new chamber for the bell. The architect for the project was Philadelphia native Bernard Sawinski of Boland Sawinski Jackson.
The design process, by its nature, puts the architect in the role of a visitor. When we started out assimilating the ingredients of the center with its exhibitry, with its needs for clarity of circulation, for its staffing requirements, everything that goes into a building of this nature. You always put yourself in the position of a first-time visitor to experience this in a way that enhances that potential. What is unique about the building is that it's what we call a one-way building. You enter at the north end, you go through an exhibit, you arrive at the bell for the consummate experience of you and the bell in silence, and then move on to further experiences to the south as you exit. That allowed the building to have a very simple diagram of how people would use it. Visitors come in all shapes and sizes and intellectual curiosity. Some people want their picture by the bell and get on the bus, so that's what we call the three-minute visitor. But there are other guests that come to visit who are interested in the finest detail, and they may stay there for an hour poring over the text and the artifacts and the exhibitry and come to the bell and ponder its significance based on that exposure. So we constructed what we called the fast lane and the slow lane, so to meet these two extremes of the agenda. And you can imagine people with a mixed interest can pick their path in between the two. So on one hand, it's a very serious journey, and one could learn a great deal about history and the significance of the bell, but one can also take it as a visit of great pleasure and still get the message of its importance. The way this fast lane, slow lane works is that in the organization of the building, we introduced a undulating stone wall whose purpose was in the building to separate open spaces from enclosed spaces like the multipurpose room or the special area for the Park Service, and to guide you from one set of exhibits to another to reach the ultimate destination and then out again into the landscape, so that as a visitor you can easily acclimate yourself to the opportunities. By the building being as transparent as it is, one could begin to understand the building just by walking the lawn outside. And there was a desire on our part to make this a kind of 24/7 pavilion that at night when the building was closed, that it would be lit and people could walk in the lawn and see the artifacts and the bell from this vantage point out on the lawn. All these things came together to define the enclosure of the building and the nature of this great stone wall that came through. Why is it a stone wall at all? Because we were interested in resonating with the materials and the detailing of the hall as a part of the instincts for the new building or the inspiration for the new building. And as you know, the coins or the corners of Independence Hall are trimmed in the stone. It's called Chelmsford granite, and it's an American granite from Vermont that we used on our wall as well. So there's the harmony of using those two. We also use the same brick bonding arrangement. There's a Flemish bond is a pattern of bricks that deal with long and short bricks, to be simplistic about it. That is the way the facade of the hall is constructed. We use the same Flemish bond on our brickwork, and even down to the detail of the mortar that holds the bricks together, they use what is called a grapevine tooling, which is how the shape of the mortar between bricks. And it provides for a nice light seam of mortar with a shadow line in that, which makes it for a very elegant wall. We use that same detail in the new building. So we have a building that resonates with the authenticity of the past, the craft of the past, but also uses it in new and modern ways that can bring into the total equation contemporary needs for environmental controls and viewing flexibility and all those other criteria that one runs into. As I walk through the building, it's always a pleasure to see how people, where they stop, what they talk about when they're viewing the different exhibits, how fast they move through the exhibits, what happens at the threshold of the encounter to the bell, and what happens right at the bell. And it changes day to day and crowd to crowd, because on a school day, it's a very exciting, stimulating place, and kids are wired. You know, they're running around, they're having a good time, and they are connected with all of this. And but it's very interesting at the when they reach the bell after they have the story around them, they learn by osmosis and reading that they stand at the foot of the bell. There's a magnetic distance between you and the bell that you automatically stop at a given point in the chamber. The chamber is composed of a low, I'll call it an introductory space, and then it blossoms into this large volume that centers on the on which the bell is centered. And people stay right at that edge between the low and the high space and look at the bell.
Architect Bernard Sawinski of Boland Sawinski Jackson, the creator of the Liberty Bell Center in Philadelphia. One element in theater that tends not to get a lot of attention is sound design. The Tony Awards, for example, annually honor the best in costume, set, and lighting design, but they don't acknowledge sound designers with an award. Yet the work of those who make a production sing or talk has not historically received a lot of recognition. Thanks to advances in technology, the field has grown tremendously in recent decades, increasingly regarded as an important component of theatre productions. Now, as part of a continuing series about what it takes to bring theatre to life, WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer provides a behind-the-scenes look at sound design.
Next time you go to a theatre production, particularly a straight play, think about what you're hearing during the show, other than actors talking or an audience member opening candy. Maybe it's a helicopter. Or scratchy music meant to feel as if it's drifting from a record player. Or maybe it's sound that has no logical connection to what's happening on stage, but it helps create a certain mood. Pay attention to where it's coming from. Behind you? From the stage? Off stage? From wherever, and whatever it might be that you're hearing, chances are it was put there by a sound designer. Which begs the basic question, what exactly does a sound designer do?
A sound designer is essentially a composer in sound.
David Badriz is the chair of the sound design program at the Yale School of Drama.
So anything that you can imagine in the realm of real sound, abstract sound, imagined sound, synthesized sounds, the entire world of audible sound becomes part of the palette for a sound designer.
Badriz says that there are a lot of common misconceptions surrounding the work of a sound designer, in part because so many facets of a theater production can fall within the purview of this role. On the one hand, there's the technical side. This might involve analyzing the acoustics of a theater, miking the actors, overseeing placement of speakers, and running a soundboard. Here, a sound designer uses technology to support or reinforce the performance and story of a play. The role also involves what's often called conceptual sound design. This entails molding, shaping, and layering sound that might be composed or recorded from an everyday environment. In short, conceptual sound design is part of a show's creative expression. David Badriz, who's been a sound designer and educator for over 25 years, says the frequent confusion about this design element has to do with many people thinking of sound design primarily as a technical field.
At one point, it might have been leaning much, much more in that direction, if not fully in that direction at times, where, you know, the development of the early Broadway shows was primarily dealing with issues of reinforcement, getting the voices up, and it was pioneering some of the new technologies and radio microphones and loudspeaker systems and controlling patterns of loudspeakers or whatnot. So there was a huge necessary development of the technology in order to support the artist. I think what's happened now is that the reality is the sound designers are turning in much, much more into artists.
Although the sound designer role in theater isn't brand new, it at least dates back to the 1960s, and sound editors and composers in film have been doing similar work for years. But Rees estimates that it probably wasn't until the early 80s that the term started to become more widely recognized and used in theater. Since then, the field has grown a great deal. Sound design programs have popped up in universities across the country. Increasingly, Bud Rees says, the profession is especially drawing designers with a strong creative bent, not just a technical background. James Sugg is a Philadelphia-based actor, composer, and sound designer who's garnered multiple awards for his work in the region. He's done sound design for about 8 years, including the electric guitar sound design sample you heard earlier, and this piece from Pig Iron Theater Company's production Hell Meets Henry Halfway. Sugg says although a lot of his work relates to simple sound effects or transition music between scenes, he gets most excited about using audio as a driving and defining element of the play, in some ways enabling the sound to be a character in the piece.
On rare occasions, sound gets to do what the actors can't do, or take the action or the emotion to a higher level. You know, there's something about the heightened emotions of great symphonies, or even sometimes of a single violin, you know, or that can express an emotion or a quality that an actor can't. So sometimes I see it as like the grand geste, the great gesture.
That James Sugg compares sound design in a play to a symphonic work isn't surprising. He comes from a musical background. But Jörg Kusino, who's been designing sound for theater and dance in Philadelphia for about 7 years, likens the work to visual art.
My background is actually in painting. So I started out as a painter. But as far back as I can think, it's always been equally interesting, the sound and the image. There's something about the combination of sound and image. How do they go together? Is there something universal about the scheme of color and the scheme or the range or the spectrum of sound that actually have a similar logic to them? And ever since I was studying in school, I've always tried to apply the same theoretical rules or criteria that apply to painting and color to sound as well.
Cusino explains that like visual composition, there's a balancing act involved with sound production. Although a designer might love freedom to be creative, the work needs to complement the narrative and fit into the scheme of a director's overall vision for a show.
Sound is not always as helpful in the whole mix because it can actually divert attention from what's most important about a story. So often it comes down to the few moments where sound really has to indicate a certain scene change or a different place or a jump in time, or, you know, sometimes it's very direct things like the phone is ringing.
Striking a balance with the right sound at the right moment is tricky, according to James Sugg. Using a well-known song, for instance, carries connotations that can extend far beyond the world of a play. Sugg says because sound can have a subtle, even psychological power to shift a perception of a scene, sometimes instantly, it can become overly manipulative.
You have to be very careful with it. You don't want to force anything. At least I don't. I want to be very careful about not telling an audience how to feel, unless that's what we're going for.
And different sound designers indeed are going for different things in their work. The field is growing more and more diverse and innovative. Yale professor David Badri says in many ways, sound design is only at the beginning of its development.
There's an incredible trajectory ahead of us, I think, a path that is very difficult to fully define, but it's certainly, at the moment, I would not consider it be a diminishing field. I think it's still finding its voice.
As sound design continues to find its voice in theater, it will be hard not to listen.
The accordion playing of James Sugg, ending that report by WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. And that's it for now. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.